Well, hello, and welcome into the Cultural Coven. I'm your host, Nicola Roy, and I am delighted you're going to be joining us for some chats with some of Scotland's much-loved arts and cultural figures. This week, I'm thrilled our guest is singer-songwriter and the man who brought you dignity, Deacon Blues, Ricky Ross. I first crossed paths with Ricky when I performed alongside him at Burns and Beyond, which is a 3-day festival that takes place in the city of Edinburgh and is a celebration of Scotland's national bard, Robert Burns. I also share a link with Ricky to Edinburgh's Lyceum Theatre. This podcast is brought to you by In Motion Theatre with an association support from the Lyceum Theatre and the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund. So hi, Ricky, and welcome into the Cultural Coven. How are you?
I'm very well, Nicola.
Well, it's an absolute joy to have you here. I also think you possibly are the busiest person I know during lockdown. So while the rest of us have obviously just been chilling on Zoom or eating, you've released two successful Deacon Blue albums in the last 12 months and headlined Hogmanay. Do you never just like fancy a wee jammy day to yourself?
Well, the thing about it is I suppose if you are a self-employed artist, you're kind of used just to setting your own agenda. I mean, one of the joys, and you'll know this as well, of being involved in the arts is the fact you don't have a boss and you don't have someone sort of dictating your timetable. And even though you have management, I've had managers all my life, it's usually, you know, the ideas really come from you and the things you want to do. So I think that, you know, I've kind of been used to that idea of setting my own timetable. And I enjoy, you know, I do something that I enjoy doing. And most of what I enjoyed doing was I would say maybe 60% of what I normally do in any given year, I was able to do. The big thing that I wasn't able to do was to play live, you know, to go out and play music. So the second half of 2020 really was a strange one because, you know, I would have been out playing. And also just the bit of the normal interaction with musicians, I missed out. So things that I was able to do on my own, write, to some extent record. I did a project that hasn't come out yet. I did a solo record, which I was wanting to do and write and so on. And I've been writing another thing and commissioned for another thing. So these sort of things. And radio, of course, which was a constant, you know, it was great. That was a lovely thing to be able to keep going. I was able to do, but you know, it's like everyone else. There comes a point where you need to get together with someone else.
Yeah, it's such. I mean, we're working in such different ways as we are today. Obviously, we're linking up virtually. Mm. And actually, I was listening to City of Love, the album that released just before lockdown, and I absolutely love it. To me, it feels very Deacon Blue. There's some really beautiful storytelling. But honestly, the burning question that I came away with was, should I be calling you Mystic Ricky? Because with titles like A Walk in the Woods or Weight of the World, did you know something that we didn't?
You know, there's a strange thing that happens, isn't there, with life that, you know, often the arts projects come along that, you know, people think, oh gosh, that was sort of prescient and, you know, it was amazing that happened at that time. But, you know, it was great for us that it connected with people, that people, I think, especially because the album came out, I think, the first week of March in 2020. The weird thing about it was that we'd got it out, I'd been in London, and I actually had been spent a lot of time in the theatre, packed theatres, because my son, my son and daughter were both in London. We all went out. Lorraine and my son and daughter, who were down there living there, all went out to see Come From Away on the Saturday, I think, before we came home. And my son's studying drama at Guildhall, so he and I, and he's like mustard keen to go. And he said, oh, you know, I said, I'm still here on Monday night. This is like after we were doing promo for a record at the beginning of March. And I said, oh, I'm still on a Monday night. Do you want to go? I'll see if we get tickets. And he wanted to see the Chekhov, the Cherry Orchard that was on at the time. I think it was the Harold Pinter Theatre. Anyway, it was absolutely mobbed. I mean, the theatre was, it's so funny because you're looking back at that. And my son had a cough. He has a bit of asthma. Coughed all the way through. And everyone was giving us dirty looks. So we were kind of in these packed theatres and packed West End of London. And I came home and I pretty well, you know, about a week or so after that, pretty well thought, oh, I think I've got something like flu kind of thing. And I think I probably had a COVID. I didn't have to go to hospital or all that kind of thing, but I had to self-isolate. My daughter's partner is a doctor. He said, you should probably self-isolate and all that kind of thing. So I kind of missed out on all the, you know, the initial thing of what was happening. But I think I was able to see the reaction to the record, which was that people kind of thought it made sort of sense for the times, which was an interesting, I mean, it just completely coincidental.
So you think you had COVID yourself and Lorraine, is that right?
Yeah, well, you know, this is like March last year, and you couldn't get, I don't know how you got tested, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't think there was it at that point, was there?
There wasn't really any sort of possibility. I don't know how you did it. And actually then Lorraine got it more seriously than I got it, to such an extent that she was one of the early symptoms of when you lose your sense of smell and taste. This really weird thing happened. I'd made something for dinner, and my son, by that time, he was sent home from London, and he was like, oh, this is really nice. It's really tasty. It was like bolognese sauce. You know, it's like typical. I said, tonight it's really tasty. And she said, really? That's tasty? It doesn't taste... doesn't taste good to me. It doesn't taste good. She said, I can't really taste it. And then she said, this is really weird. And it was this is so early on that had picked up on the fact that people were losing their sense of smell and taste, but she did. So we both kind of went through the thing, which we're fortunate enough to think that was, you know, we got away with it quite mildly. I think maybe Lorraine certainly had it longer than I had, maybe that was what happens. I don't know where it comes, you know.
Sure.
Who knows?
But she's all good now. She's feeling better now.
We're all good now. All good now.
I'm glad. And so I don't want to obviously dwell on lockdown too much, but it is strange, you know, if we didn't talk about it, did either of you get into the old banana bread making or Joe Wicks, or did you partake in any of that sort of lockdown stuff?
No, what we did was we did a bit of what my sister has a kind of Swedish side of her daughter is married to a Swedish guy, and she keeps telling me about Swedish death cleans. So we did a lot of cleaning out. You know, so Swedes go through this thing where they do a lot of purges in their house. And I'm a great believer in it, because if you don't do it, you're faced with horrible choices. I actually do... regular throwouts. I collect so many. I get sent so many CDs, as you can imagine.
Of course,
radio
yeah.
Show. And I did another radio show, which involved getting a lot of books, which I didn't necessarily always want to keep. So I did regular purges anyway. So we did a good amount of sorting things out, and then we did a lot of stuff in the garden. A lot of work that Lorraine bought a power hose and started clearing up things, painting things, you know, things that we'd normally get maybe someone else to do, we did ourselves. And of course the weather was so good, we were doing lots of this stuff outside, and yeah, just I think that was where our domestic energy went. We didn't do too much of
that. So you might be starting a wee side lane and like home removals or something. House cleaning. I'll definitely get you a van. I know that I remember you telling me that you both like to walk quite a lot. Is that something that you've done more of during lockdown? And you know, you're pretty sharp dressers, the two of you, I always think. Do you go for the full on like rambling gear?
Well, here's the thing. In the summer we did walk, and you know, I know everyone's done this, but you know, when it gets to that point where you think, well, what are we gonna do this weekend? I think the first long walk we did was, so we're in the south side of Glasgow, and we walked way over to the East End, through the Gorbals. Lorraine's got lots of connections to the Gorbals. A lot of the Irish community came through the Gorbals, so she kind of knows that area. And it's funny because we'd actually recorded in the Gorbals the last record in the studio there. But you know, you don't spend much time walking through these places. And the funny bit was, you know, even though it was locked down, wasn't a lot of kids and people out in the street. It was just a Sunday afternoon, a Saturday afternoon. But we did a lot of that. So we went, and then one day we went up to a place that I'd always wanted but never been to, the old Glasgow Cemetery, just above the Glasgow Royal Infirmary, where the statue of John Knox is. And you know, there's a lot of these places, you think, why? You know, I've lived here for over 30 years and never done it. So we did that. We walked south one day. Yeah, did a bit of walking. And then during the snow recently, it's so difficult to get moving. And Lorraine bought these phenomenal things called cleats, what you put on your shoe, you know, like they're like spikes. Did one walk on them and they broke. So I can't honestly recommend them. They're kind of rubber things. I thought, it felt good, but it didn't fully work.
You're talking about, taking in places that you haven't maybe necessarily noticed before. Do you tend to write from what you know and from, growing up in Dundee? Is that an inspiration in your writing?
Well, it's become that. It's interesting you ask. I mean, on the last record, I went back to kind of memories I had as a child. There's a song called On Love, which is sort of the song that a lot of people related to on the record. It's really a spoken word thing.
Yeah.
And it's a lot about memory. And actually, it starts with a memory of my grandfather in Dundee. So yes, it does. It goes through. In fact, it maybe actually never really leaves Dundee. I think it kind of wanders into Edinburgh at some point, but it doesn't really actually leave Dundee, which is not honestly something I often do. I tend to, I suppose, just you tend to write where you live. I think I'm kind of one of these people that tends to set things where I know them. And stories tend to happen from places that I know. So I suspect I go back to Glasgow a lot and set things where I know. I can imagine people moving around if it's a particular story. But it's almost like song by song, I'd have to think about it, you know?
Was that always the plan to do two albums in 12 months, or was that influenced by COVID?
It was hugely influenced by COVID. It was a bit of luck, really, or whatever. Oddly enough, Lorraine had written a song right around the time of Love, and I'd forgotten about it, which is not something we normally do. And after we'd finished the record, I found it, just going through stuff on the computer. That was really weird, but do you remember the song? And we had a really good demo of it. And I sent it to our manager and said, you know, this seems weird, but I don't know why we forgot about this song for City of Love. It would have worked well. And then we had a big discussion between him and the label and us and the band, and said, well, actually, you know, if we go on tour, still was up in the air at that point. Maybe we could put it out later and it could be strapped on the album. And as the year went on, discovered we're not going to go on tour. The idea came back and forward. And eventually our label said, you know, actually, a single's not much use to us, because we can't really, you know, with your demographic, we've got to be realistic. Our audience are my age. And maybe a wee bit younger than me, but you know, they're not people going out and buy singles. But could we make it into an album? And we then discovered that we had these other, we knew that we had some songs left over from the record. So it became a kind of, again, a lockdown project that we hadn't planned to do, but it felt like something that we would be able to put out, and just have a connection with people, you know. Just, we're not going to go on tour. And when it's funny when you're on tour, although you're on a stage, I mean, you know this as well, there's still a connection with people. You know, you come to the stage door, there's people there.
Yeah.
You know, we used to do a lot of meets and greets and stuff like that as well. So you do meet people. And just not meeting anyone, you know, not really formally connecting with any audience felt strange. So I think it was just a way of us doing something which connected with people, I think.
So I first met you in 2019. I'd met Lorraine previously in acting auditions, but met yourself when we were doing Burns and Beyond in Edinburgh. And I don't think I told you this at the time, but I actually had no clue I would be working with you until my wee auntie called me up because she'd read about it in the evening news. And I was pretty excited because to me, there's not many bigger Scottish bands than Deacon Blue. But what I did observe from you was that you were so calm during the sound checks. Are you just naturally, do you get no nerves with performing, or do you do any kind of rituals before? Because I do a few strange ones, like
very
I tell
calm.
You. That's a combination of Barocca, Haribo, a banana. Haribo has been the cause of a few near-death experiences for me before I go on stage. A few actors have had to stop me choking.
Really? That's interesting. No, I do get nervous. I think when I'm with the band, I'll be real honest, I mean, I think some nights with the band, when we went to play the Hogmanay, it was a... we were nervous because we hadn't played all year. And we're in a BBC studio. It was really weird. And literally, you know, everything was just different. Everyone was in the whole crew. There's no audience there. There was crew in masks and it was television. You know what I mean? And we were playing songs that we didn't really know. And it's quite funny. We did Riding on the Tide of Love. And we got through, because I think we did that first. Let's get that over with. And literally, I cocked up the second verse. And but I was so determined, like, we're kind of, let's move on beyond that, that I sort of said, no, that's a take. That's fine. I'm talking about the lyrics. I muffle it. You know, it's like, if you go back and look at the, don't go back and look at the YouTube, please. But if you do, you'll just say, oh my God, he's terrible. And I think that was nerves. It was just like, you know, because we hadn't played the song before. And even though you know something, you don't really, you know what I mean? You don't know something until you've done it a few times. You'll know that.
Yeah, and it's in your muscle memory. It takes a while, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's that point where you just don't have to think about it. But when you're thinking about it, it's just useless, you know? So yes, I do get nervous about that. And sometimes I get nervous when I'm playing a solo show. And sometimes I think, oh, what the hell? You know, why did I agree to do this? Because I remember I basically started doing solo shows again to overcome a kind of form of stage fright, to be honest with you. I was doing a songwriting thing in Belfast. And it was four of us on a stage, and we'd gone out for something to eat and chatted at least the other three really great writers, and we got on really well. We had good fun, and I think I had a couple of glasses of wine. I think I was just completely just not being prepared, and I got halfway through a song and forgot the second verse, and it freaked me out. I got away with it because I just joked. I mean, I got away with it in the sense that the audience didn't stone me off the stage. But I didn't get away with it in the sense that I would think about it, you know, like weeks later, think, oh, why did that happen? This used to haunt me a little bit. And so I actually literally thought at one point, it's a lot too boring a story to go into here, but I did start doing solo shows, absolutely solo shows again, to sort of prove to myself that I could overcome, if that makes sense.
My little thing is I will say a little prayer to the theatre gods to get me through. Do you have a faith yourself?
Yeah, I do, and I have a very deep sort of Christian faith, and it's evolved over the years. I mean, I'm a practicing Roman Catholic now, and that's important. I mean, important to me in a sense that I feel comfortable in that form of worship, but not important in the sense that I feel I have any more right to the truth than someone of a different faith or someone of a different type of Christian faith or someone of no faith. You know what I mean? It's not something I feel I have to be superior about, but it does help me.
You were talking about keeping Deacon Blue, the performances different every night. So, and I know that you had a break for a while. Is there a difference between Deacon Blue version one and Deacon Blue version two?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I think the middle bit was a bit muddled. And we didn't, you know, there was a definite break. And then we got back together and that was slightly half-hearted because we only effectively replayed shows. And of course, we only played shows with material that was old. So the second part of Deacon Blue was, you know, and I have to say, Gregor is a huge part of this. Gregor Philp, who came in to play guitar, was great because we started working together. And Gregor, you know, in a sense, you know, had brought a lot of energy. And also it coincided with when we decided eventually, when Gregor started playing with us, actually, and Jed, who's his friend, who now plays with Simple Minds, but Gregor and Jed joined us for a tour when we didn't, because Graham had died in 2004 and we were still using other, so, you know, a different ensemble of people. And Gregor sort of said, you know, you should just go back to the lineup that you have, just, you know, one guitarist and one, you know, just six of you, and we can do this. And that made his attitude made a difference, but also we were kind of looking for new management and we eventually found the right person. Tom O'Rourke has been managing us and me for the last 10 years. But before that, we went through different people and it didn't work out. But one of them, who's still a good friend, when I was kind of searching around, sort of said to me, you're a band, you need to make an album. And I didn't know, it sounds odd, but I didn't really know how to write for a Deacon Blue record at that point. And I just went back. His enthusiasm just got me started. And we made and wrote The Hipsters, and I think we started that album, making it in 2011, came out in 2012. And from then we haven't stopped. It just feels natural. And I think what felt natural for me was when all my life I'd wanted to make a record, and Deacon Blue was the band that eventually made that happen. And instead of just worrying about it, I just went, just write the songs that are in your heart and it'll happen. And that's kind of, that's the difference. So Deacon Blue 2 is different, totally different, because it's, you know, it's a different, you know, we started from a different point. You know, for the first band, everything that happened to us for the first time.
Sure.
And that was amazing. You know, that was incredible, you know, journey. You're going from playing to no one, and sometimes playing to people leaving, you know, just, you know, all that kind of stuff, to actually having some success. But where this time it was just making sure that we were creative, you know, being creative and sort of bringing an audience back, as it were.
And I mean, I can't not speak to you and not talk about Dignity. For me, it's such an iconic song. Do you write from experience, or was it, what inspired that?
It's interesting you ask that, because I kind of think it was a breakthrough song for me, because I think that I was trying to write something that was important, that felt like it was, you know, actually meaningful. Mm. And it wasn't just filling up the lyrics of a song. It was kind of, songwriting's like a lot of things that are in the arts. Yes, there's a sense of which you've got some sort of gift, but there's also a lot you can learn. You can teach yourself about it. You know what I mean? So when you have the rudiments of it, I think you can still learn. I think you can still learn all your life about it. There's things that you just can get better at. And I think, though, I was writing, and I think I had the seeds of some writing, I think I still hadn't written, you know, the song that you know, this is, you know, this is my song. You know, this is like, I can go out and say, this, I've written this, you know, and at least, you know, sort of wave it in the air. And I think that was I knew that something had happened after I'd written that. There was something that, you know, just even the lyric, I thought that's a story worth telling. So that was a marker for it. I was abroad. I was in Crete on holiday, and fun enough, there was a music paper with me, and I think it was an interview with Morrissey, and it was the headline on it was Home Thoughts from Abroad, and I thought that's a good idea. You know, the Robert Browning poem, and I thought, yeah, because you can write, you do reflect more on where you come from when you're away from home, but.
Yeah.
Actually, where I lived at the time, south side of Glasgow and Pollock Shields, I think there was a cleansing depot, and there were these guys walking up and down the street with brushes, and I never quite made, you know, sense of that. But so it's a combination of all these things, and thinking about what would happen if, you know, at the time it was huge unemployment, what would happen if everyone did have jobs, and what kind of jobs would they do? And so it was all these things sort of coming together in a very short couple of verses, really.
I honestly absolutely love it. And I'll tell you what I love even more was seeing yourself and the lovely Lorraine crooning with Gary Barlow during lockdown. What a highlight. how did that happen? Did Gary just get on the blower and was like, here, Lorraine, get your handbag. Love, let's have a dance round the kitchen. Like, what happened?
Gary contacted our manager and said he wanted to do it. And Tom phoned me and said, Gary wants to speak to you about this thing. I didn't know Gary at all,
right.
And I knew who he was, obviously, and so we had a great chat on the phone, and I said to him, I don't know, what are we going to do? And so we'd come up with a sort of, because I didn't quite understand the concept, and I said, well, maybe we should just, you know, we always sing in harmony. I didn't even understand how you do it technologically, because how do you do these things? And he said, oh, no, just... I just do your biggest song. Just you know, let's do Real Gone Kid. I love it. I bought it. You know, so he'll set up his version, and then we sang to that. But actually, Lorraine and I couldn't hear each other when we did our own version. We just kind of knew it. You know, I think we kind of knew what each other would do. So she sang to Gary. I sang to Gary, and then Gary put it all together, and it was really good fun.
I hope you followed up with Relight My Fire.
No, I'll tell you how I followed it up though. Interesting enough. When he phoned up, I'd been, my producer at BBC, I do this series of conversations, kind of like we are doing now, except I'm you, on kind of people with long songwriting careers and artist careers. And we'd wanted Gary for it. And we'd got the usual kind of management. Oh, you know, maybe later in the year. And I said, Gary, do you fancy it? Yeah, I said, no problem. So within a week, I'd recorded a thing with Gary, which will come out on the BBC.
Oh, I look April, forward but, to that. And actually, talking of fun things, I think it's time for a wee creative challenge. We thought that we would send you a wee creative challenge just to rewrite some songs. So if I give you the first line of the song, I would like you to rewrite the subsequent line. And I'll tell you who it's by as well. Okay, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, so number one is hashtag selfie by the Chainsmokers. And the line goes, after we go to the bathroom, can we smoke a cigarette?
Because it will help the smell evaporate. Evaporate, cigarette. Doesn't quite rhyme, does it?
I love it. It sounds evaporate. Like a good government campaign. You're onto a winner there, mate. I love it. And number two is Shotgun by George Ezra. I'll be riding shotgun underneath the hot sun.
But I will never understand that expression.
Either will I. Love it. Okay, number three. A personal favourite of mine, Beauty School Dropout by Frankie Avalon, and it was in Greece. The line goes, Beauty School Dropout, no graduation day for you.
You're homeschooled now and your folks are drunk and confused.
Half of Scotland are feeling the vibes. The Cultural Coven is delighted to have musical support from singer-songwriter, musician, member of the Red Hot Chili Pipers, and very importantly, a fifer, Cameron Barnes. This song, Coming Home, and the rest of Cameron's music is available on all the main streaming platforms. So go on, download it and have a wee dance about your kitchen. Thanks, Cameron, for letting us use this tune.
And I actually, oddly, am the person that probably is the biggest theatre fan in the house. Maybe not anymore because Seamus is about, but I would be the one that would maybe have gone, always all my life, gone to the theatre as a, you know, relaxation. I love going to the theatre. I go to the sits a lot since I've, you know, lived in Glasgow. Come to the Lyceum when I'm in Edinburgh, the Tron, you know, all these sort of places. And you know, and then London, I always go. If I got a night off, I'll go on my own. So, you know, going to see her in the theatre, well, that's always a bit slightly, you know, I was nervous the first nights. But, you know, I love doing that. You know, it's great.
Because actually, I was reading your letter to the Lyceum, which pays homage to a drama tutor. So did you see much theatre as a boy growing up in Dundee?
I mean, probably more teenage years. I got taken to pantomime quite early and got scared when I was a wee boy.
Oh.
People running up and down the aisles, you know, that kind of way. And then my earliest theatre memory was with my grandmother, who I never did very much. This particular grandmother, my on my father's side, took me to see Francie and Josie, a theatre that's now burnt down not long after the Queen's Theatre in Dundee. And I loved these guys on the telly. I just thought they were the funniest people. So I was a wee boy, and I absolutely loved that. And I think I loved it because it was in colour as well. And then as a teenager, I started going to, you know, late teens, I started going to the theatre, going to the Rep in Dundee. And again, I kind of drifted away from going to football, and I would go to Saturday afternoon matinees and sit my own because it wasn't something you did with pals. But I loved it, you know. And then when we were at college, I was doing teaching, college English teaching. And I don't know how it worked these days, but we used to get subsidised, you know, grants to get, you know, if you got student tickets and free transport, we got a minibus, and we used to go off to see things. And we saw a lot of great things. And so it just became habitual just to go to theatre. The only time I ever worked at the Lyceum was I did music for...
Was it As You Like It you did it for?
No, it was Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh, Much Ado. I knew it was a Shakespeare. I didn't see. When was that you did that, Ricky?
Well, it was Kenny Ireland's time, early 2000s. And I did the music. And it was really nice. Got the chance to set some songs, Shakespeare songs, because there's lovely songs in it as well, to music and so on. And we used a lot of, just background music. But I loved doing it because it was sort of such a release, of a different project.
I was going to say, how does it differ doing music for theatre? Because I know you did the choir as well at the Sits, which was Paul Higgins. Mm. He wrote the musical, and you wrote the music for it. I actually did my first ever acting job with Paul, and such a lovely guy, so very different to his character in the thick of it, thankfully. But you strike me as someone who always likes to challenge themselves. Is it very different doing music for theatre to your other work?
I think it is, because you really have to, realise that it's just got to be where it's needed, sort of thing. I mean, that was a particularly difficult, I wouldn't say that was an easy project to do, but you learn from it, and there was moments of there was some great good people involved, but the nice thing is, fun enough, you kind of learn each time. And it was a thrill, it was a thrill to have a musical and get it on. And there was a whole talk at the time of it going on tour and so on. I think with musicals, they just always need a lot of work. I mean, you always need to go back. And you can see that in even West End musicals.
I'm just wondering if you had a lot of actors saying, see that line, Ricky? I don't think my character would sing that, because we're quite bad for doing that in rehearsals. great. So... I'm sort of sensing you maybe don't have any more plans to do more musicals, or is it never say never?
No, I actually do. I mean, I won't say much about it at the moment, but that is one of the things that I've been working on in lockdown. It was a commission that, oddly enough, just came about then. And so that will, watch this space. It's quite an exciting one as well, so I think it'll be good.
Okay, yeah. Well,
enjoying it so far.
Can I bag you a wee part? Come on, can I bag you a wee part, Ricky?
Well,
keep me in mind. All
yeah,
right?
I just promise that. I say that to everyone. Yeah, of course you can. Of course you can. No, it's got nothing to do with me.
I'm just being cheeky. Whilst we're talking about large scale music and musicals, I can't not speak to you without mentioning the Queen, Dolly Parton.
Obviously, I have a huge interest in country music. Dolly Parton is, as you rightly say, the queen of country music. I mean, she's in a league of her own, really, in terms of, being of that vintage, a woman of the 60s, really, who started a career in television and duets with Porter Wagoner in the 60s, breaking through in the 70s big time, but then keeping going 80s, 90s, so over decades and decades and decades. And then, of course, doing movies and doing songs, songs for movies, books, you name it, all sorts of stuff.
She's so talented.
But essentially, all through that time has been a songwriter. And that, I kind of feel that at the bottom line, I'm a songwriter. And I really admire people who are songwriters. Dolly's also an interesting thing in Nashville, that most people co-write songs. It's quite a big tradition. She did when she started with her uncle, but all her songs, her famous songs, are really 100% Dolly songs. She's groundbreaking. I mean, there's so many aspects to her. And I was frustrated, because for years I would turn on the radio and radio tour doing anything with Dolly Parton, and it would just be kind of like almost an interview of her being a gay icon or something like that. Which is nothing wrong with that, but it felt to me like it missed a whole, significant bit of what she did. And we were on the same label. We were on CBS Records and Sony in the 80s. And one night we went to a CBS conference. You should never do these. It's like seeing how sausages get made. You want to enjoy them, but not see how they're, how it happens. And it was all the sales guys talking about albums that were coming out. And this sales guy got up and basically just did a whole thing about Dolly's tits. He just did Dolly Parton. She's got too big. It was like, I thought, what the hell? And we were so annoyed. This is like 1988 or something like that. Lynn and I walked out the sales conference. And I'm like, no, I'm not. If you're going to speak about artists like that, you're going to speak about my favorite artists like that, I don't want to be on your label. I've absolutely, I never told her this, but I just, because it would be horrible to have to tell her what, how her label had been. She probably knows, you know, but it's so frustrating to me that people did not, men, a lot of men would interview her and not take her art seriously. And I thought, and the frustrating thing is perhaps even that Dolly herself allowed that to happen, you know, maybe it was complicit in a sense. I think, oh, I've got to do this because it's, you know,
sure, and it's what people expect. Quite, you know, different times at the start of her career as well. But I mean, it's so frustrating because she's a highly intelligent, highly talented woman, and to try and just sort of diminish her to, you know, their what suits their agenda.
And it goes on and on, you know.
Yeah. Talking of other great women, yourself and you know, the lovely Lorraine have also had a very successful relationship. It's over 30 years you've been married for. And I feel like this industry doesn't necessarily always lend itself to happy marriages. What is the secret? Is it a secret?
You know, we often say, people say this to us, and we say, what's the deal? You know, it's like you marry someone that you love and you like it. You know, but I don't know. I'm nuts on her.
No, I can see that is so lovely, and I can completely understand why. She's such a gorgeous woman. You know, can you?
Oh yeah, she's.
You
know, oh yeah.
If you don't like what the other person's doing, can you go, actually, sorry, that's actually not very good. Or
Lorraine's my most honest critic, and she's doing a creative project just now, which she'll always ask me about, and I'll say, well, you know, it's what I think, and blah blah blah. But yeah, you know, we try and comment, but we've also got, you know, four kids between us that are great friends, and you know, we're a close family. You know, we're a close bunch. Although we can't always be together at the moment, which is very frustrating. But I think that, you know, we like a lot of the same things. We got together because we liked a lot of the same things. Even musically, we like a lot of the same things, and we like hanging out together.
I heard you mention that you were an English teacher, which I just recently heard about. So was the plan always to be a musician, you know, a singer, a songwriter, or was the plan to be an English teacher?
I think I was like most English teachers that I knew at the time that your plan was to be an English teacher until something better came along. I enjoyed it. I did it as a job to make some money. At the time, I was qualified. Odd enough, I was remembering something. I actually asked this question on Twitter the other day because I'm trying to write something at the moment. And I was in my final teaching practice. I did drama. I was an English and drama teacher. And I was at high school, in Whitfield High School in Dundee, and there was a guy there whose name I now remember, called Bill Garvey, a great guy. And he had a brilliant relationship with the kids. The kids just loved him, and he put on shows. And, you know, people are obsessed with discipline problems. The kids just, you know, he had all these kids doing all, everything, you know, drama. And it was just brilliant, absolutely brilliant stuff. And actually, as it happened, this is like towards the end of my degree, so my final teaching practice, and he said, I've been promoted, I'm getting a job. I can't remember where he was going, but he was going somewhere as head of, you know, drama or something like that. And he sort of said to me, look, why don't you apply for the job? I'll put a good reference, you know, you seem to know what you're doing. I was just copying him. I was seriously tempted, but by that time I'd agreed to go off and actually work in a completely different direction. I didn't really want to teach. So I ended up doing youth work for a couple of years, which was what I wanted to do. And I ended up teaching for a couple of years after that, which is really something I did as a job. But again, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed working with kids, and I loved a lot of the staff that I worked with. Again, it was a kind of fairly rough area. This was in Glasgow. But I still see kids that were, well, they're now middle-aged, older folk, you know, older men and women who will bump into me occasionally in the West. The school was in Maryhill, and I'll bump into them. And but no, I didn't. I honestly didn't want to be it. And I didn't think I was very good at it. When I was teaching, I was kind of had an eye on being a musician, to be honest.
It wasn't an outside influence from your family, and then were they quite happy that you were going to...
My mum was a teacher. My mum was a primary teacher. She was a great teacher, and kids loved her. But my dad, my mum, kids thought I was nuts, you know, giving up my job. They just thought I was crazy. And at the time, you know, you look back and you think, what would I think now if someone, one of my offspring were sort of giving up their job to go off and join the rock and roll circus, you know, I would you're nuts, you know. So yeah, I mean, they were kind of, looking back on it, they were as understanding as they could be.
I'm sorry to hear that you lost your mum at the start of lockdown. It must have been really difficult, especially with the, you know, further restrictions as well. It must have just made it even tougher. Really sorry to hear about that. It sounds like she was a lovely woman.
Yeah, she was. You know, that generation. She was 92. My mum when she died last year, and we were. She had terminal illness, so she was always going to be ill. It was only a matter of time. That was well before the lockdown happened. And obviously, when we were first in lockdown, all we were doing was just trying to look after her. We were kind of lucky. We were, you know, I've heard terrible stories of people not being clearly not with their close relatives when they've died. And terrible stories. And so one of my sons-in-law is a doctor, and those stories of putting, you know, phones and iPads in front of patients to say farewell to their family, you know, terrible stuff like that. And we weren't like that. My mum died in August last year when there was no COVID. I mean, there was no COVID in that hospital where she died.
Okay.
So they were being very cautious, but they were allowing us in, and we had a fantastic, amazing staff in this ward that were just brilliant to be with, who were great about my sister and Lorraine and I and my brother-in-law coming in. You know, we couldn't bring the whole family in, but we were allowed to come in on a daily basis and just be with her. So it was, you know, we were, compared to lots of folk, we were really, really lucky. There are so many worse stories, I have to say. And my mom had an amazing life and a good, you know, what I think people recognize as a good death, you know, a death where you're ready to go and you're with your family.
I know. Yeah. I'm glad that, you know, brought you some comfort. And talking about kind of other inspirations in your life, somebody that I've heard a lot about over the years was the celebrated singer-songwriter Michael Mara. One of the infamous stories I've heard about him was that at the start of his career, his publisher said that they didn't want too many Scottish songs, but he responded by writing an album of entirely Scottish songs. Liz Lockhart always tells me that story. He sounds a total legend. I unfortunately never had the chance to meet him. But was he a big influence on yourself, being a guy from Dundee?
Yeah, Michael, I think, was a huge influence. I mean, I saw Michael really early on because he was in a band called Skeets Bolivar, and they used to play every Thursday night in a place called Ling's, which is a bar just beside the art school in Dundee, down Rosangle. And they used to play these long shows. Michael played bass, believe it or not, in this band. His brother Christopher played as well. And then just towards the end of the 70s, early 80s, he sort of made a solo album, and that got a bit of publicity. And I remember going to see him play, and I just thought he was great. And I bumped into him one night. He was drunk. He was just outside the pub. He was smoking a pipe, would you believe? And anyway, I can't remember. I was kind of involved in putting on a gig, and I think I asked him to do something. I can't remember. Anyway, very early on, not long after I moved to Glasgow, a lot of people in Glasgow didn't know him.
Right.
But I sort of kept up with him. We wrote or something like that. And then I got him through to do a benefit show for folks who were going out to work in medical aid in Nicaragua. And we did the show. It was like one of these nights where I just asked everyone and everyone just said yes. So I had Pat Kane was doing it. Wet, Wet, Wet were doing it. I sang it. This is like before Deacon Blue really bought our first record. Anyways, lots of folk at it. And so all these people were at it, like, and heard Michael. And so Michael came along and played this thing. And I always remember Pat King going, who is this guy? You know, and of course he heard the song. And then of course Pat ended up with Hugh and Cry covering Mother Glasgow. And I think almost that night kind of opened up Michael to a sort of new audience in Glasgow. This is the Third Eye Centre at the time. And we stayed in touch. And then Michael came out on tour with us in 91. And, you know, looking back on it, I remember, you know, we used to write letters to each other. And even later on, I would get fed up with things. And I'd say to him, oh, really fed up, you know. And he would, you know, he'd be great. Say, well, you know, no one can stop me making music. And all, you know, he was great for all that. And then Gregor, who plays guitar with us, Gregor was very close to me. And I say Gregor really did know him much better than I did, because played in the bands and knew all the songs. You know, they kind of, you know, always put these things together. And I played with Christopher for a while as well. Played guitar with him. So I then, just before Michael died, his kids were out on tour with us. So the Hazy Janes, which is Matthew and Alice at the time, were in the band, and they were out on tour with us just before that. So it was came as a real shock when he died, because I don't think even they knew how poorly he'd been, and it was really sad. But yeah, I mean, an amazing influence, and still is.
If you were to speak to someone who was just about to go into the industry, is there any piece of advice you would give them?
Apart from don't.
apart from that, you know, because I don't think they'll be swayed, but...
No, I think that... I wouldn't say that anyway. I just think that I really admire people who make music, because I think it's hard. I think it is really hard to, at the moment, you know, especially just now when you can't get in play live and even think of you maybe get some money back on what you're doing. It's hard. And of course, the whole business of how to market music has changed. No, I think do what you want to do. I think the people I think that always succeed and have the careers that anyone wants are the people who make the music they want to make and are part of that. Because odd enough, you and I've seen this happen with young songwriters, you can end up being, you know, persuaded to make music that you don't really believe in, you know, that maybe someone thinks you should be making or whatever. And of course, if you don't believe in it, it will never come across to anyone else as authentic, and you'll not love it. You know, you've got to start by loving it yourself. So I think you've always got to do the things that you really, and that may sound incredibly obvious, but believe it or not, I think some people do get sidetracked into things that they don't really want to do. And I think that there's a whole lot of people out there who just want to be famous, and look, that good luck to them. And they'll do anything to do that. But, you know, you or me are not interested in them. And I don't think you'll ever be interested in their music. I think the people that are interesting are people who just do things that are, and that's why I kind of love quite eclectic music. I love when I hear someone who's a brilliant, you know, bluegrass banjo player or something like that, because it's just their thing, you know. In the same way that I don't know, electronic stuff that I haven't heard or, you know, whatever, because it's just, you know, it's them doing it, it's them doing their thing well. So yeah, do your own thing and keep going at it.
I think that's why I love your radio show so much, because you're such a brilliant supporter of you know, new talent, but also you give a bigger platform to established talent as well. And I just think yourself and Lorraine are very supportive of emerging artists, and that's something to be celebrated. I'm going to go into a little quick fire question section. Now, be afraid, because I absolutely will judge you on your answers. Are you ready? So it's just a choice of one or two. And go with your instinct. Okay, here goes. Okay. Classics or modern?
Classic.
TV or theatre?
Theatre.
Faulty Towers or Only Fools and Horses?
Faulty Towers.
Chippy sauce or no chippy sauce?
Oh, you mean Edinburgh chippy sauce?
Yeah.
Yeah, I that's a good thing about Edinburgh for me. Yeah,
yes,
definitely.
Man
definitely.
After my own heart, love it. The Bard.
Definitely.
The Bard or Burns?
Oh, to be honest, I know this is going to be controversial. Now, this is where the podcast will now get taken off the air. I'm going to say The Bard.
Oh, okay. All right. That's all right. The Slosh or the Macarena?
I wouldn't know where to start with either. So you can just pick your own. Yeah.
Let's go for The Slosh, okay? Stage left or
stage
right?
Yeah, may as well.
Stage left or stage right?
Stage left or stage right? Oh, we always come, well, I think we always come on stage left and go off stage left. So I'll say stage left.
I think that apparently that's where the eye's drawn to more, I believe. The Stalls or the Grand Circle?
Oh, Stalls.
City or countryside?
Yeah. City.
A buffet or a la carte?
Oh, a la carte. You don't want a buffet in
town. You're a posh boy. There we go. Records or digital?
Right.
Records or digital?
Well, actually, to be really, really honest, I like both.
Okay.
And I, yeah, I love records, but you can't play them in the car, so digital.
That's fair. Fancy Nancy or Dress Down?
Dress Down, because I'm not good at dressing up. I always look at myself like, oh, no.
Give it a You're trying to tell me you're sitting at home in your jammies, that's it.
No, I don't. I dress, but I don't. I can't. I'm not good at dressing up. No, I'm not good.
Well, you strike me as a very sharp dresser. I'm quite surprised at that one, actually. A football or a rugby?
A football.
Bollinger or beer?
Oh, I think champagne's overrated. That's a bit too kind of like rock and roll. Yeah, well, I always think, oh, what's the point? You know, you one glass of it's quite nice, you celebrate, you do a big thing, you know, but
it's quite pricey, the old champagne.
Exactly. Yeah.
Lambrini girls have more fun, as they say. Okay, that's brilliant, Ricky. Thank you so much for your time. I hope to catch up with you soon in person, maybe drinking some press night nasty wine in a theatre bar soon.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. That'd be great. Listen, good luck with your podcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening in. And why not join us next week when I'll be welcoming actress and comedian Elaine C. Smith into the Cultural Coven for some hilarious chat. Until then.